it's a big world.
My guest today is Professor Roman Shiremeta, who is Associate Professor of Economics at Case Western Reserve University, co-chair of Ukrainian American House, and founding rector of American University of Kyiv. Welcome, Roman.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome.
Thanks for doing this. So I got some of your papers, and as I mentioned to you, we talk a bit about Ukraine in general and the war that's going on there. I'm very ignorant of this area and its history and everything, but my knowledge is not substantially inferior to, I would say, some of the American policymakers and some of the folks who were on the stage in the Republican debate last night. So I don't feel too bad about it. But we want to talk a bit about Ukraine, its historical context, why this war is happening and all of that.
Sure.
But before you get there, I want to put the context. So you have a sort of a special issue. It's entitled Theories of Conflict and War.
That's right.
And you say it aims to bring together different perspectives on conflict and war from different disciplines: economics, psychology, evolutionary biology, anthropology, political science, and management. That's an eclectic mix of disciplines.
Yeah.
And I would imagine I can understand how they would think about conflict and the theory behind it. We will talk about economics in more general later. But if you think about other disciplines here, what are the commonality that you see, how they think about conflict and war?
Yeah, so this was a issue that I added together with Eric Kimbrough, who is a good friend and co-author of mine. And it was in a very prestigious economic journal. And, we put a really cool team of people, really specialists in all their areas, to talk about conflict, war, contests. As it just happened, this is my field of research. You know, I'm a behavioral economist, but I have applied the tools that I have learned specifically to contest, war, conflict, and alike situations. So when we talk across different disciplines, they do look at the conflict and war quite differently. For example, if we talk about psychology, you know, psychologists usually think in terms of conflict as, you know, the innate motivation that guide us, you know, to engage in conflict. They sometimes even talk about conflict within yourself, right? So you can have an interior conflict, and that's the way that they approach from the cognitive perspective. When we talk about anthropologists, they study basically from the perspective of the evolutionary biology, right? So why we evolved in the way to be the kind of species that learn how to cooperate over time. But at the beginning, we were really fighting for survival. And so there are a lot of really interesting approaches from anthropologists, mostly from the evolutionary biology perspective. When we talk about political science, they really embrace the conflict and war, how we think it is, you know, it's a geopolitical context, political conflicts, context, and so on and so forth. When we talk about economists, so this is where I am really an expert.
Yeah.
We really talk about conflict as resource exhaustion in order to get some sort of reward, right? So you spend resources because you're expecting that you will win a certain prize or you will gain a certain territories. And it's all in the perspective of management of resources. And this is how economics is all about. It's about the study of the people make and the choices that they make they cope with the problem of scarce resources. So how do you use those scarce resources in order to maximize your utility, your payoff, your profit, so on and so forth. So very different perspectives, you know, from these different disciplines. And that's what was so interesting about this issue, you know, special issue, that it brought all of these minds together, talking about the same context of war and conflict.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. So going to economics, so you have another paper, War and Conflict in Economics, Theories, Applications, and Recent Trends. You say here theoretical treatments of conflict range from quite general models examining the trade-offs between conflict and production to more specific models examining optimal behavior in a variety of conflict institutions. These models vary in many details, but the implications are in many ways qualitatively consistent, you say, highlighting key commonalities across a variety of conflict settings. And so you have a few models here, contest models, war of attrition games, guns versus butter models, spatial conflict model. I find all of them very, very fascinating, Roman. So I have a background in economics, not deep background, but I sort of thinking about, so how do they differ and what are the commonalities among them?
Yeah. So when we talk about these different models, let's talk about, first of all, the commonalities. The commonalities are going to be, well, there is a fight for a prize, right? So there is some sort of prize. We can define it in a, spatial model in the distance, trying to cover a bigger distance. In the war of attrition, it's kind of, think of that as a pulling the rope. You want more of that rope. If it's in a contest model, it's a physical prize or, monetary prize. So there is a prize. And the common finding is, of course, as the level of the prize increases, there's more fighting. So it's a really interesting and fascinating finding, and it's a quite straightforward. I think nobody is going to argue with that one. The more interesting nuanced one, but it's still a common more or less across these different different models, is that when you have a fight between an underdog and somebody who is, let's say a superstar in a way, there is actually quite interesting dynamic there. So the underdog usually gives up in the fight. We call it the discouragement effect. So the underdog in the fight, usually backs down, and the superstar doesn't have to fight as hard either, because they know that their dog is not going to fight as much. Now, there are some exceptions, to that rule. For example, there could be a case when their underdog is going to fight really hard, but most models will predict this discouragement effect. This is what we will call the common finding. There's also interesting basically application is that as the number of players gets bigger in a conflict, the conflicts actually most of the time the total intensity increases, of course, because you have more players. But individually, each player is going to be actually less engaged in the conflict, because their likelihood of winning this big conflict actually goes down because there are so many players. So there's these typical incentives that we as economists study. And that's and in terms of response to these incentives, we find that these different models have more or less similar predictions. Now, when we talk about the differences across them, the difference is going to be first in terms of application. The second one, the difference in terms of actually modeling. So what are we modeling? In a spatial context or in spatial contests, we're going to model, this fight in for distance. The distance is really, you're trying to capture more territory, more market, depending what the specific model is. And the point is that it's harder for you to capture when you are more away from your base, right? Because it's further away and it's easier to capture the territory that is closer to you. Then if you talk about guns versus butter, that's sort of the idea of trade, typical trade-off in the economics, where if you're going to spend money all on guns, you're not going to have any butter. And so you need to balance it out. And what is the right equilibrium, given that the other countries also going to be deciding that trade-off for them as well. And so some countries going to spend more on guns, others more on butter. And those that have more guns will more likely to attack the countries that have more butter, and so on and so forth. And then there is international trade that comes into play there. So there is a really interesting models, and they all look at the conflict war contest from different perspectives.
So I want to get back to Ukraine now in terms of what's happening there. All the human suffering, everybody can see it. As I said, I'm not I don't know much about this area. But it's an experiment, it's a laboratory in many ways. And so from an economic perspective, you can ask multiple questions. What is causing this war? So ultimately, as you say, there's a price. So there has to be some economic benefit that the aggressor is seeking here. So what do you think that is? Why do you think this war is happening?
So let's talk first of all, what are the typical narratives that are put in the media, because you know that's where it all starts. And then let's talk about the real motivations, you know, as we look at this. So let me first of all talk about the narratives that are being put forth. So for example, a typical story that the Russian propaganda will try to convince you is that it's a war. First of all, they were fighting Nazis, right, in Ukraine. Apparently, you know, me and other people in Ukraine, we are called Nazis because we don't want to live under Russian occupation, you know. Or there was another one that Ukraine was bombing, you know, the eastern regions of Ukraine and all of that. There's another one that NATO expansion, it's because of the NATO. And Russia commonly blames, basically, now that's their favorite narrative today because, you know, that's the one that they chose to focus in a recent month. And it's all the fault of NATO. If NATO didn't get involved, you know, nothing would have happened. So these are the typical, you know, narratives that happen. Now, why the war really happened? I mean, it's a historical context. It's a really simple as that. Russia has been trying to conquer and conquered Ukraine for over 300 years. That's the history. We know about the genocide that was caused by Holodomor, which is a starvation of Ukrainian people. Millions of people died because of Stalin's regime. They really eradicated Ukrainians. They starved them to death. They were deporting people. And this is way before, you know, NATO, before, you know, all of the narratives that exist today. And it was already in the making. You know, Russia was an empire and it is still an empire that basically has a lot of people under their control, a lot of nationalities. And so basically this mindset was never went away. So this is really the main motivation that, as I see, Russia still believes in that imperialistic worldview that they are the empire. Putin, in his own admission, he said that the biggest mistake of the 20th century was the fall of the Soviet Union. Basically saying, you know, that's what he really believes. The biggest mistake, that's his own words. He repeated it many times. So basically, they're trying to fix the history. They're trying to fix the history that they believe that went, you know, wrong. The Russian Empire should have stayed together. And that's really where all the motivation comes from. It's as simple as that. It's an imperialistic ambition. And that is why it is so dangerous for the rest of the world, because if we go that far, well, how about we restore the British Empire? How about we restore, you know, a French Empire or, you know, Italian Empire? Let's go all the way to Roman Empire and, you know, and go that direction. So we
are more difficult. Exactly.
So this is, you know, this is a real motivation behind it. You know, that's now, of course, as an economist, I cannot help but also understand that, you know, there is a lot of things that came in this war that played out as far as a behavioral kind of aspects. Now, because I'm a behavioral economist, I cannot help but mention that and say that the reason why Putin even engaged in this war was because, you know, they had a very specific, beliefs. And so let me just give you a couple of them. So one of the biases that we examine in behavioral economics is called overconfidence. So basically, a person's subjective confidence is greater than the objective reality. You know, when I ask my MBA students how would they rate themselves relative to the other MBA students in the class,
they're all above average.
70% of them are above everybody else. I mean, it cannot be 70%. When we ask in the US how good of a driver you are, 90% of the drivers will say they're better than the average driver in the US.
Yeah, completely.
So, yeah. So, and then, and if you think about this narrative of, you know, Russia being the second army of the world, they're going to take Kyiv in 2-3 days, Ukrainian government will run, Ukrainians will not fight, you know, for Zelensky because they, you know, they didn't appreciate the president that much. And I mean, I guess this last one is also is true in a way. Ukrainians are not fighting for Zelensky, and Zelensky is just, you know, he's an important player, but relatively, you know, he is doing the bidding of the people, not the other way around. So overconfidence was one of the reasons why Russia has made this, you know, this step. Another one was the confirmation bias. Basically, you know, Putin has surrounded himself only with the people that said yes and believed his narrative, right? He said, we're going to do this, and everybody, we're going to do this. So think about everybody who was in the opposition to Putin, like Prigozhin, like Hirkin. I mean, Prigozhin is already dead, presumably dead. Hirkin is in the prison. You know, and anybody who would say anything against the narrative that self-confirms the biases that they already had is going to be out of the picture. So, you know, and there's other things that play into this war. Why, from the cognitive perspective, what motivated Putin and the Russian regime to get engaged in this war and now continue? Like, imagine there's another bias called sunk cost fallacy. Once you start investing in the resources or spending time and money on a specific thing, and what happens is that you, even if it's going to be unprofitable and bad to you, you're still going to engage in that behavior in order to recover those losses. Even though they already sunk, they're gone. You're not going to recover them ever, but you're still going to make it worthwhile, right? We've lost Russian, you know, are talking about, we lost so many troops. We lost, you know, half of our tanks. We need to make it worth it, right? Worthwhile for us to have started in the first place. So this is all of these narratives, they play out in this cycle, viral cycle of continual conflict and war. So that's basically on a psychological level why it's happening what is happening.
So let me see if I can sort of understand this, Roman. So there is imperial ambitions. USSR is gone, but maybe Putin doesn't buy that. There's Russia. The original USSR has lost a lot of its territories, and Ukraine was part of that USSR regime. So that's that motivation. Let's get back and become big motivation. There's also, if I understand this correctly, so the overconfidence you talked about. So when he went into Georgia, when the world was sort of distracted by other wars, things sort of happened as he expected in some ways.
Exactly.
And so he's using the same template, it looks like, in Ukraine.
Yes, right? That's correct.
So that's part of the overconfidence part. But there's a significant economic question here. So Crimea and areas around it has a lot of resources. And I understand, so there's a sort of a resource question here. There's so hydrocarbons that you want to get hold of. And I understand that Crimea has a water problem because after the annexation, Ukraine decided not to send them any water through a singular river that they have access to.
Let's start unpacking these things and we can talk more about this.
Yeah.
So let me just go from the very end. So Ukraine didn't close the rivers to Crimea, but they could have done it. And obviously, once Russia is engaged in a full-scale war, Ukraine would have stopped that. So basically, but for since 2014, Crimea did have access to water, and Ukraine, because one of the premises is that Ukraine is operating that Crimea is Ukraine. And so they don't want for the Ukrainian people who are still in Crimea to suffer because, you know, and so they actually didn't stop the water there then. But, you know, now maybe they would consider because of the Russian full scale invasion. But let's now go back to this other idea is that the resources are there. And that's why, you know, Russia, for Russia, it is a lucrative possibility. Now, look, Russia is the biggest country in the world. They literally have virtually unlimited resources. They have everything that Ukraine has times X. So really, the resources in Donbas are not, it cannot be the main reason why Russia is, you know, wants the territory. It's just, it's very minimal, relatively, to what the real motivation would be. Now, I'm not saying it's
even with the new findings in the Black Sea.
So the Black Sea is a bit different, and the reason is the Crimea Peninsula really gives a strategic base for the naval and the Black Sea operations. So because of that, for Russia, the Black Sea is the Crimea Peninsula is sort of the most important kind of defense from the Western Europe, because it's far enough and close enough. It's accessible by the sea, so you cannot really fully stop the, you know, access to that peninsula. So the point is that is a strategic post. So I can buy in, but Russia already had Crimea in 2014. Right. So they have occupied and you know, it was there. So I don't really think that, you know, it was so important for them because they already had it. But now we go to the very beginning when you'd mentioned Georgia, and we can go also to Moldova. We can go also to the Azerbaijan versus Abkhazia, all of that. And so what you will find is that Russia has constantly used the same narrative, the same scenario. I actually study, I use this example to teach my students in the game theory course of, you know, the behavior of Russia. And I explained that the step that Putin made in Georgia was very rational. Now, why I'm saying that? Because he'd done this before. And he never was penalized for that, right? Yeah. He would annex, he would take part of Moldova, you know, he would create in other areas, he would create calamity, and there was never a pushback. Then he went for Georgia. Again, there was not significant pushback. He went for Ukraine, for annexing Crimea. And again, what, for example, that case, Obama didn't even bother to put any sanctions in place or help Ukraine in any way.
Obama had a red line, and Putin crossed that red line, and they said, red line is gone. Yeah,
exactly. So he basically, based on these previous observances, you know, he kind of deducted for himself, well, this is how it's always going to be. And this is precisely why we need to really draw a hard red line right now and help Ukraine with everything that we can, and we can do way more, because if we don't stop this today, when is it going to end? We need to punish Russia for this kind of behavior. This will also prevent any further potential wars in the future, because if China, God forbid, decided to invade Taiwan, they know that what's going to come for them is the same story that what happened with Russia, meaning that everybody is going to be behind Taiwan. They're going to support them and even engage physically with China. So China will know, well, we cannot invade Taiwan because we don't want to have the same fate that Russia has.
Yeah, so, I mean, war is such an antiquated concept that I would imagine the younger kids today would find it really difficult to understand. You don't go into another country, you don't kill people, you don't kill school children.
Yeah.
I mean, these are stuff that we thought we left behind.
Yeah.
But it's happening now.
Right.
And so, so from a policy perspective, I mean, this is quite interesting, right? So, so there are a lot of countries helping Ukraine with hardware and other support. And there's a larger question in terms of exit, right? So when do you, so what do you think, so knowing Putin's ambitions of making USSR happen again, which is, you know, in a smaller way at least, when do you think he will realize that may not happen? And how do you think the war could end?
Yeah, so this is a tough question. This is a very tough question, obviously, that is very real to Ukrainians on a daily basis. And now, one thing that I can tell you is that, and then this is not, has nothing to do with President Zelensky, has nothing to do with the Ukrainian government, anything you mentioned, you know, corruption, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. What matters is that there is Ukrainian people. And all of these people, they don't want to give away an inch of their land because it is their land. It is their freedom. It's like, you know, if there was a robber that came into your house and said, hey, I'm going to live in one of your rooms, and you'll say, oh, yeah, okay, that room can be yours. No, you will never do that. And that's because you have such an attachment to your house. Now, imagine how much more attachment you have to your land, your territory where you grew up. That's, you call it your homeland. So Ukrainians will never basically back from that. This is Crimea will never be Russian. The next territories as of now will never be Russian. Now, so what could happen, and this is a potential way to have some sort of ceasefire, is that when Ukraine is going to say, well, we're not never going to recognize this territory as Russian, the international law, international countries will never recognize this as Russian. There could be a diplomatic way to resolve this. And until the sanctions are not, you know, until these territories don't become officially Ukrainian, the sanctions are going to be in place to, you know, to punish Russia for holding these territories. But there is no killing, you know, there is sort of ceasefire. And I think it's going to be a tough sell for Ukrainians who don't want to stop fighting until they recover the territories. But, you know, I think it's a political step that Zelensky and his team and whoever is going to be running the country may consider taking in order to preserve Ukrainian lives and sort of stop the war. The sanctions are going to stay with Russia until they are occupying these territories, but, you know, there may not be as intense fighting anymore. So this is one scenario that I see as plausible.
Yeah.
Ukraine could also, there could be another scenario where Russia basically backs up and there is some concessions made on the precondition that Ukraine is not going to join NATO and any other alliances, which is, you know, was never really, you have to understand that.
It's not enforceable.
Yeah, so enforceable. So first of all, it's not enforceable, but, you know, Ukrainians never wanted in the first place to be a part of NATO. So if you go into late 1990s and you look at the surveys of people asked, you know, if you want to join NATO. And so about 20% of Ukrainians wanted to join NATO. There was no point of joining NATO. We wanted to be even the constitution of Ukraine was written in such a way that the country was not part of any bloc, sort of alliance. And when Russia annexed Crimea in 2014, that percentage jumped to 50%. I mean, there were different polls, but more or less 50% of people wanted to join NATO. Now the it's almost 90%. Almost 90% of people want to join NATO in Ukraine, precisely because it's a response to the Russian aggression, not the vice versa. Russia is always trying to say, oh, NATO is coming. So it's no, Russia is coming. And therefore, NATO will be as a response to that. So this is in terms of these kind of scenarios that could unfold. And of course, another one, that Putin dies and there is some sort of significant reshuffling that happens in Russia. But I don't think that Putin, this is where I would actually have a lot of debates, even with Ukrainians and other people, but I don't believe that Putin is the problem. He is, as I've said it many times,
he's a symptom of a much bigger sickness,
you know. And so, if Putin is not there, we can get even somebody much worse than him, you know. So this is why I'm a strong proponent for really giving Ukraine everything they need to stop Russia right now, and make them pay such a price that they will never ever consider doing anything that stupid, because we've done this mistake before. We've made this mistake before with Nazi Germany. When Britain tried to, you know, say, oh, you know what, Poland you can take, but don't take more, you know, or some other countries. And so this was a really a problem that we have faced before. We know that aggression and terrorism cannot be negotiated with. And so this is, yeah.
Sorry, Roman. So let me ask you sort of a United Nations context. So we have 200 countries in the world. I don't know the exact numbers, but I think 180, 185 of them condemned the invasion. It is by international law, you couldn't do this. So, you know, condemnation is automatic in most cases. But we have 15 countries or so, I don't know the exact numbers, who either stood on the sidelines or actively supported the invasion.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, these are large countries. Some of them are autocratic, some of them are apparently democratic. They're large countries and they house almost half the world's population. And so I don't know if United Nations has the power anymore to enforce international laws. I mean, if Putin travels to 150 countries in the world, he's going to get arrested. Other 50? Not really. So he can pick his countries where he wants to travel to have a vacation. So there is no unified international law. There is no unified enforcement of international law. And so is United Nations is really relevant anymore?
Yeah, so this is a very painful subject for me as far as, you know, the United Nations goes. I just opened up the votes here. So when we were talking about the annexation of Ukrainian territory, it's actually only in condemning Russia. So basically only five countries voted no. So 144 voted yes. There are some abstentions, strategic ones, but the countries that voted no is Russia, Belarus, which is basically, you know, as a Russian number two, right? Yeah. You know, dictatorship, North Korea, Syria, and Nicaragua. So these are not democracies, none of them. And they are not only democracies, but they're authoritarian regimes that already eyeing other countries and, you know, are very problematic in themselves.
But abstentions are also interesting, right? Abstention basically means that you are not willing to stand behind principles.
So
right?
you still want to do business with Russia. That's what abstention means. You know, basically, right. If you're condemning Russia, then why should you be doing business with Russia? But Russia is, as I said, one of the most resourceful countries in the world. And so countries like India and China have benefited tremendously from Russia's isolation from Europe and the United States, because, you know, the trades with India and China went through the roof, you know, since then with Russia. So there are countries that are benefiting then, and that's why not condemning Russia is a kind of democratic, I don't know if it's democratic, but it's a it's a way to you know, still do business as usual. Now, that being said, let's go back to the United Nations. I completely agree with you. It became a useless organization, unfortunately. The fact that we have Russia that has done this genocidal aggression that is, you know, historic in its context, and still sitting on the UN Council, you know, basically that's the decisive power. It's like, you know, having Nazi Germany being on the United Council. Why
on
not?
On the Security Council, yeah.
Exactly, on the Security Council. And that's just ridiculous. It just points out to, I understand that some diplomats make an argument that's the only available means of communication with these countries still, right? North Korea. I mean, we don't have diplomatic any relationship with North Korea, but at the UN there is, you know, representation, and there could be some you know, communication happening there. Now, as I said, I think that it's actually very impotent. It really lost its credibility. The UN, it lost its power. It's this organization, and it's very unfair also to the African countries. You know, if you go to the UN representation, the UN Council representation, you know, some of the biggest countries are not there. And I think historically, it's been unfair to the African countries, which is also known, but the point is that with this conflict and this war has just clearly demonstrated that, you know, something needs to change. Needs to change in UN. Needs to change, you know, in the security world security network.
Yeah. So the larger question then is, so I mean, economics. You and I understand, you know, there's a profit maximizing motive. Whether it's a company or a country, but there are a set of laws, set of rules, international laws that you have to adhere to. So suppose I find lithium in Belarus, I cannot just go get the lithium. I mean, this is why it put these rules into place, right? So, right. And when you do stuff like that, there has to be repercussions to it.
Yeah.
The whole international community has to come. So Security Council, as you say, is very lopsided. I mean, the number of nuclear bombs you have is not sufficiently robust metric to say you get automatic admission Security Council.
The interesting thing, it's a historical context as well. Russia was never voted as a part of UN. It's United Nations because Ukraine actually formally requested and it was admitted to UN after the fall of the Soviet Union. There was a USSR, which is the, you know, and Russia kind of felt that their grandfather into UN as a result of the fall of the USSR. Because basically admitting that they are the empire that gave birth and basically we should be continuing, but legally, they never, after the fall of USSR, USSR is a part of the UN, but not Russia, because all the other countries, they sort of made the application, but Russia is technically, legally, is actually not, shouldn't be a part of UN, which is an interesting case in itself. But anyway.
Right. So where do you go from here, Roman? So, from an economic perspective, so it looks like, if I understand you correctly, you are saying the primary motivation here is sort of making Russia bigger, you know, going back to the USSR days.
Let's talk about the bigger is a good word to use it. But bigger in more than the territory sense, right? So the bigger in terms of the empire, right? So the empire, it's the ambition. You know, Putin is writing his name in the history. You know, he is expanding the territories of Russia. The Russia is now the global threat again, as it was during the Cold War. And, And so in that sense, that's what I agree. I don't think that bigger in terms of getting a smaller piece of Ukraine as anything adding additional value to Russia as a whole country. It's the biggest country in the world already. I mean, what else do you need?
Yeah, so if that is the real incentive, real motivation behind the war, how do you think it could end? I mean, what are our choices to end this war?
Well, as I said before, the scenario that I see is that Russia gets punished to a sufficient level that they basically understand that they will lose this war. I mean, Ukrainians know Ukrainians cannot lose the war because it's their territory, and anybody who believes otherwise is just doesn't know the history. I mean, think about any country trying to invade another country. Let's say U.S. trying to do its war in Afghanistan. I mean, Afghanistan is not Ukraine. Ukraine is a much more powerful country. And U.S. is not Russia. U.S. is much more powerful country. And yet, U.S. couldn't do it. They tried for years and years, and they had to withdraw. Now, imagine now we have Ukraine fighting Russia, and there is a lot of resources behind Ukraine as well from other countries. So there's just they have no chance of winning this war. No chance, literally no chance. And we can go and look at other examples. And so the only way that they will really sort of end, and the sooner it's the better, is when they really realize that just really there's no chance for us to do this. We lost almost all of our army. We cannot replenish our tanks. We cannot replenish our rockets as fast. We are becoming a laughing stock for the rest of the world because we were supposed to take Kyiv in 3 days, and now it's already 6 years. So if the war were to continue, into the future, obviously that will be more and more difficult for Russia to sell as like, oh, we are winning the war. It's just ridiculous, and it's already becoming ridiculous at this stage. So this is why the support of the Western countries is so essential for quicker ending this war. Because if the Western countries are not going to support Ukraine, Ukrainians are still going to fight. They're still going to fight on their own. But it's obviously it's not going to happen. But still, I'm just pointing out. So the more we inflict damage on Russia, the faster this war is going to end. Hopefully, Putin is going to be repelled by his own people and his own, propaganda that will say, well, you promised us this and we have nothing, So that's my hope, and my hope it's gonna end sooner than later.
So I know that you have to go. So as you mentioned, there's some strategic advantages here. As a Chinese autocrat sitting there salivating over Taiwan, how the world responds to an aggressor that is against international law has a foundational effect on all countries. It's not just China. There are other even supposedly democratic countries looking to annex small countries around it. Annexation is not allowed in international law. So the world has to respond to it in real terms. And Ukraine has to win this war, I would say, not for just this war, to sort of make the point that international law will stay.
Absolutely. So let me just give a final kind of word explaining why this war is so important and why standing with Ukraine is just, I mean, it's the only reasonable choice that we have as a world society. First of all, it's the right moral thing to do. I mean, you would not be standing on the Nazi side, in 1940s. You wouldn't say, oh, I mean, this is the same story that repeats itself. It's the fight for freedom. Anybody who stands for freedom, and especially in the United States, if we're talking about, America, we are the country of liberty and freedom. So if you stand for freedom, that's why you should be fighting for Ukraine and helping Ukraine, standing against tyranny and dictatorship. If you are against those things, this is why you should support Ukraine. Preventing any sort of future terrorism, you know, we are obviously want to punish any acts of terrorism. Now, why say terrorism? Well, because it's when you kill innocent civilians, destroy their livelihood, the winter is coming. And during the winter, what Russians will most likely do, they'll start continue bombing the electric grids for people. So they're really making the miserable life for people, which is what terrorists do. They just, there's no military target there. It's just, terrorism. So if you stand for the international law, if you believe in the sort of agreements that have been made in the past, like Budapest Memorandum, that, you know, we promised security guarantees to Ukraine, you know, in Budapest Memorandum, and now we are sort of, oh, Ukraine should deal with its own problems. In terms of strengthening NATO, I mean, NATO today is the strongest as it ever been because of this Russian aggression. Now NATO is actually countries, we in the US, we were pushing NATO to move that direction, to spend 2% of their GDP on defense, and it was very difficult to do. Today, NATO, they all understand that that's the only way to secure peace in the world. In terms of return on investment, when you at the expense of some percentages points of the defense budget, the United States has basically taken down half of the army of one of their major adversaries in the world and the threat to the global peace. Yeah. In terms of who you mentioned this. On the geopolitical benefit, you know, other countries are watching, like Taiwan and others. And if you want to create this world security, that is the only way for us. And so if you are rationally thinking, moral person, I mean, the choice should be very obvious.
It's now, also game theory.
It's a game theory as well. And you just need to ignore the Russian propaganda and the narratives that have been put up as a false narratives. And just at that time, things become very obvious for me. They've been very obvious from the day one. And I appreciate and thank everyone, including you, who have been standing with Ukraine and helping us out. And I hope that I'll get back to studying the war and conflict in more peaceful time.
Excellent, Roman. Thanks so much for taking part in this.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.